Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And today, we usually do this monthly. I want to give you a report, Richard, of what's happening in the art world, the dumb things, the fun things, the new changes, and in the art and collectibles and antiques and museum world. And so this show today is about that kind of thing. One important lead headline is that if anybody's ever sold anything at auction, auction houses are, well, since the pandemic, they've become the place to sell things. And everybody during the pandemic had some experience with an auction, whether it be an eBay auction or other auctions, Sotheby's, Christie's, Bonhams, Moran, and any kind of auction house like that was just going great guns because, of course, people could do that online and they could do that at the computer, et cetera, et cetera. So auctions became the place and they made billions and billions for the 3 years or so that we were experiencing the COVID issue. So now they've got enough money, so they're fat and hungry for more action. And Sotheby's, for example, is changing its fee structure. So Richard, there's the buyer's premium. So whoever's buying the work, let's say a painting or a piece of furniture, whoever's buying that pays a premium to the auction house above and beyond what they call the hammer price, what it's called out. You know, let's say it's a painting and it's $2,000. Well, usually the buyer will pay 26%. And it goes, funnily enough, it goes down, that the percentage goes down as the price of the object goes up. And so let's say, okay, it was 26% that the person's going to pay on a $2,000 painting. Okay. The seller also pays a commission to the auction house, and that's negotiable. Lots of times it's split about even, but usually the seller who is selling it, if the auction house feels that the piece is really desirable, sometimes they'll be really cheap with the seller's commission. They'll be either 1 to 10%, which they would pay from what the proceeds are of the sale. So in the case of $2,000 painting, they're going to be, let's say it's 10%, they're going to be $200 to the auction house, for example. So it's a very lucrative business model, but Sotheby's is changing its fee structure. It's lowering the buyer's premium across the board. They've lowered it to 20% of the hammer price on works, any work up to $6 million. Wow. So that means that they want people to come and consign work to them. They want that, and they want the buyer's premium. They want new business. They want new people to buy. And they want the younger generation to become collectors and start to buy. So they're saying, okay, we're going to do buyer's premium. Whoever's buying it is only going to pay 20% to us. And like I said, the buyer's premium previously was 26% for works a million or less. Now, what about the seller's premium? So from if you're selling a piece that's 1 to 5 million, then your premium seller's permission, sorry, then your seller's commission is going to be 20%. And then, but if the auction house really, really likes something, they can lower it to 10%. So, and you know, if it's above the $5 million range, big collectors, like the big collectors will sometimes sell major works of art, let's say $20 to $50 million pieces. That's what the auction house really wants. And so they are going to say, okay, fine. No seller's commission. You owe us nothing for all of the marketing we do and the promotions we do and the activity around the auction. You owe us absolutely nothing. And you take Not only do you take what the piece sells for, because actually they want that kind of level. They want the $20 to $50 million level. But they also have an agreement that a seller of that stature, if you're selling $20 to $50 million work, a seller of that stature will take 40% of the buyer's premium as well. So they get a cut of the buyer's premium too. So it's really lucrative. So Sotheby's is looking for new business. They're looking for new business on both the buying and selling end, and they're lowering their commission rates and they're lowering their buyer's premium. It's quite interesting what's happening. And I think, you know, that there's going to be a flurry of activity.
Sounds like a nice side job to take, you know?
It sounds what, Richard, say
like,
again?
Like a nice side job to take.
Oh, an auctioneer?
Yeah.
I think you'd be good at it because it takes a lot of vocal acuity, I guess you'd say, which you have. And it takes a very quick mind.
Yeah.
And it also takes like an intuitive reading of what's happening in the room or in the marketplace. Used to be in the room because it was closed room and, you know, you knew what was going on with your audience. And it still is in many cases an open forum, a live auction. But there's also a part of it that's on the computer, that's on the phone, that's international. And but the auctioneer is totally in charge and he has the right to go up or down. He has the right to ignore somebody or call on somebody if they raise their... I mean, it's a really quite a forceful position. And there's been really famous auctioneers over the years that make an auction house a lot of money. But they're usually almost like psychic, intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of know. They know what's happening. They can pick up on the vibe. They can pick up on the energy. It's pretty amazing to see a really good one at work. I want to tell you, Richard, about the lawsuit that's been going on at Sotheby's, by the way. This past Tuesday, Sotheby's was cleared of claims that they helped the Swiss art dealer Yves Bouvier defraud the Russian billionaire Dmitry Rybolovlev. Now, the issue was that Sotheby's head of sales was accused of altering prices so that, you know, the dealer could buy it less expensive than actually was the value of the work. And we're talking really big works of art, a Da Vinci, for example. So the issue was Sotheby's was accused of lowering prices or altering prices so that the dealer, Bouvier, could hike up that price a lot, greatly, and flip the painting to, or paintings, to Rybolovlev. And so it was a fix. They were claiming that in court, the Russian billionaire was taking Sotheby's to court, claiming that they were price fixing for the dealer. And it got me thinking about how a dealer works. And I thought it was really interesting to talk about how a dealer works and what a shady dealer looks like. And let me tell you the story, how this came to be at the trial. So Sotheby's is being sued by this Russian billionaire. At the trial, they hired the creator of the FBI's art crime team, former agent Robert Whitman. He was responsible over many years of recovering stolen works of art and teaching police departments how to investigate art crime. A real experienced gentleman when it comes to art crimes. Now, he explained to the jury how to spot a dirty dealer. He was acting as an expert witness in the Rybolovlev case. And the Russian, of course, billionaire is suing Sotheby's for colluding with the dealer, Bouvier. Okay, on the stand, Whitman said, this is how you spot a dirty dealer. Number one, look at how the wealthy collector, in this case, the billionaire, and the dealer met. Okay, and the two ways to watch out for that are the hallmark of a dirty dealer who's setting up a relationship is number one, the what they call the vouch. And by the way, this applies to all dealer-client relationships. I don't care if it's a car dealer, et cetera. Any relationship where the client can be taken. The question is, Richard, how was trust built? Okay. Mm-hmm. A vouch. What's a vouch? What's a vouch, do you think? What do you think a vouch is? And what do you think a bump is? The vouch or a bump? These are the two hallmarks of a dirty dealer.
The vouch would probably be sort of a... it's like you are vouching for someone, and maybe this is
a
document.
That's right. A vouch would be that you have a friend introduce you, the dealer, to a client, and this friend vouches for you. But here's the kickback, or the kicker, I should say. This friend is not really acting out of friendship. This friend gets a kickback whenever the client that you've introduced him to, whenever they buy a work. And so in the case of this billionaire, Rybolovlev, he bought work to the tune of a couple $1 billion with a B over a period of 6 years. Now, the friend that vouched for him, for the dealer, Bouvier, the friend that vouched for him, there was an actual friend that vouched for this dealer, received 6% of $2 billion.
Oh.
And that's just for setting up that introduction. So that's the vouch. What do you think a bump is?
Sounds an awful lot having to do with the price of something.
It's I bumped into you. So the bump is when a dealer scrutinizes where, let's say, the wealthy collector hangs out and then bumps into them.
Ah.
Coincident.
Okay.
Right? But they're watching. They're watching the way the client handles themselves, the way they spend money. They're watching. They're spying on the client for a while before they actually, quote unquote, bump into them. And then this Whitman, the head of the FBI art crimes, is also giving a clue as to, you know, that this is also coming into the play of trust. You know, how do you trust? So you trust your dealer, let's say, to, in many cases, you trust God, you even trust, let's say, a car dealer, drug dealer, you trust the dealer. And bad things can happen if you don't trust them. But in this case, this expert is saying, watch out for the way they embellish the tales of how they acquired a work for the collector. So if they say, let's say, gosh, I pulled out heaven and earth to buy this painting for you. It took me a number of years. I worked on it constantly. The former owner was really intractable. I had such a hard time, and the owner just gave me a run for my money, but for you, I acquired this work, and goes on and on and on. Well, no, he bought it at auction. So if he's making things up, that's another indicator. The trust is not there. Third, a dealer may charge a significantly higher price than what the dealer has bought the work for, and nobody has to know. And of course, then on top of that, the dealer is charging commission. And, you know, many collectors don't say, well, what did you acquire it for? In other words, you're buying a house, Richard. You would say to the realtor, what did it sell for 7 years ago? In the case of the art world, the dealer doesn't have to tell the client what he acquired it for. And, of course, it's public knowledge if he acquired it at auction. But if the auction house is not disclosing the price, which is what was accused in this case, well, then you'll never know. So somebody can jack something up. In the case of this trial, Bouvier was jacking things up 10, 20 times more than what he paid for such a thing. And that's legitimate. I mean, it's legitimate, but it's still a sign that, you know, you've got a dirty dealer on your hand. And Whitman was expert witness because Rybolovlev had been charged, overcharged $1 billion for a collection of 38 works over 6 years. So he was overcharged $1 billion. And in fact, the billionaire met the dealer through a vouch. If you're interested, Richard, who was this vouch? The vouch in this case was a close Bulgarian friend, quote unquote, who introduced Bouvier to the billionaire. And unbeknownst to Rybolovlev, she was paid 6% of all the works that sold, like I said, $2 billion.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's an interesting story, but Sotheby's was found to be not guilty of the charge of price fixing. The jury decided, it was a Swiss jury, and the jury decided there wasn't enough evidence. Anyway, that's the story of the major art trial between really big powerhouses with a lot of money, both cases, the billionaire and Sotheby's. Let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to talk about, you'll love this, Richard, the Newark, New Jersey Mafia and their art crime. you would think, a mafia guy from Newark, New Jersey is interested in art. Well, yeah. Let's go to quick break. We'll talk about that when we get back from the break. Welcome back. I promised that I'd tell you the story, Richard. In Newark in 1969, the local mafia decided they were going to try their hand at stealing really good art and fencing it. Well, first of all, I was surprised that there was any really, really good art in Newark, New Jersey to begin with in 1969. But it turns out that a priceless 18th century painting called The Schoolmistress, a very stern, dour-looking schoolmistress. The mafia stole this from a 96-year-old doctor's office in 1969, and it has been recently recovered. It's been gone ever since 1969, so that's, 54 years it's been gone. But I had to laugh at that. I have been to Newark. I fly in when I visit my family in New York. I fly into Newark. And I've had the misfortune of staying in Newark overnight when the plane was delayed or something. This is not the I know they're trying. Mm-hmm. But anyway, now what's happening with the art world in terms of really important celebrity auctions? Well, in Beatles news, in 1966, the Fab Four were stuck at the Tokyo Hilton due to death threats by Japanese nationalists. So they got together in one room, the four of them, and they painted a psychedelic painting called The Images of a Woman. And that painting is signed by the four Beatles and is coming up at auction at Christie's. And one of the original Beatles, did you know there was an original member of the Beatles that never stuck with the Beatles and kind of lost out on the fame? His name was Stuart Sutcliffe, and Stuart was one of the earliest, there were foursome, and Stuart was one of the four. His estate, he was interested in his friend's achievements, and he collected Beatles memorabilia at a very high level, and he collected his own memorabilia when he was on the road with the Beatles. But he also collected the Beatles in general, any kind of memorabilia, 400 paintings, sketches, drawings, letters, photographs, memorabilia. All that is coming up for auction. So the whole collection of the early days of the Beatles, documented by Stuart Sutcliffe, one of the original members, that's coming up at auction. Hmm. Well, Madame Curie's 1914 laboratory at Paris Curie's Institute was under the wrecking ball. They were going to build a new state-of-the-art facility, and the historic lab where Madame Curie made her great discoveries was about to be knocked down. and a bunch of preservationists formed a line, Stop the Wrecking Ball. The Ministry of Culture in France got together with the historic preservationists and has vowed to rebuild the famous laboratory brick by brick, stone by stone, as part of the wall was already knocked down. Fantastic story of saving a historic building. On January 31st, Richard, something really important happened in the aerospace world. And it has to do with a new museum in Los Angeles. January 31st, the Space Shuttle Endeavour took its final journey to the future Samuel Ocean Art and Space Center at Los Angeles, California Science Center. Do you remember, Richard, in 2012, when the Endeavour was coming, it had been flown to the Los Angeles airport, LAX, and it was going to go to the California Science Center, and it had to go via road, had to go via Los Angeles roads to get there. And they had to expand some of the roads. They had to knock down some of the traffic lights because the wingspan, I think, was huge. What is it? 80 feet wingspan, something like that. No, 78 feet wingspan. And so they had to, you know, clear 78 feet of road to get this space shuttle to the California Science Center. Well, they decided that at the California Space Center, a donor, Samuel Ocean, has donated the money to build the Air and Space Center. And there's a couple of towers that are being erected. And what they're doing is really cool. They're taking the Endeavour, which has been shown at the California Science Center, on its belly, and they're taking the whole space shuttle and turning it upright so the nose is pointing up. And they're taking that space shuttle, pointing it up, and they are mounting it to in between these two towers. So it stands there between these two towers, and it's flanked on either side by a huge 80-foot fuel tank and all kinds of other equipment that it would have been accompanied the space shuttle. And you know, Endeavour was the last space shuttle ever built. It had a 19-year career. It made 25 space voyages. And I myself and my son had been to see the Endeavour inside the California Science Center. And it was displayed horizontally. And it's been displayed that way for the past 11 years. But Tuesday night, massive cranes lifted the Endeavour, nose up, in a vertical takeoff position, to stand beside the future towers of the museum. And crews used, believe it or not, an 11-story crane to hoist the Endeavour's tail and support the tail. And they used a 40-story crane to lift the nose. And they had to do this with absolute precision because it's wedged between two towers that are being constructed. And the rudder needed 18 feet clearance. And so if you've got 18 feet clearance and a 78 foot wingspan, you don't have much margin for error.
What so a spectacular, also, spectacular thing to see.
Marvelous engineering. And it was done in the middle of the night. Next to the Endeavour is a 15-story fuel tank, which is painted orange, and Endeavour's rockets. And the 20-story proposed construction of the two towers will be built in a few years, apparently. And they will be showing the Endeavour, and this is the aerospace term, full stack. Full stack means in a launch position. And it will, like I said, do you remember in 2012 when the streets and traffic lights were cleared to roll Endeavour from LAX to the Science Center? And now it's going to be part of the architecture. How cool is that?
Very, very cool.
Just happened this past week. Okay, let's go to quick break. I want to talk a little bit about the a museum show devoted to the Rubik's Cube.
Oh,
remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute.
Thank you.
So there's a museum show happening in Budapest at the Budapest College of Art and Design relating to the Rubik's Cube. Well, Richard, who invented the Rubik's Cube and why?
Well, I'm just going to take a shot in the dark. Some guy by the name of Rubik's.
Actually, Rubik.
Rubik.
Singular.
Rubik, singular, sorry.
Yeah. And what his first name is Erno. Erno Rubik. He invented in 1975. I thought it was older than that. But in 1975, he was a professor of architecture at Budapest College of Art and Design. And he designed it and patented it in 1975. And the reason he made the Rubik's Cube was to get his students to think creatively about geometric forms and spatial relationships. Because, of course, he's an architectural professor, and he's wanting his... So, and the thing took off. Basically became, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars made for this professor who patented this Rubik's Cube. And it's still around people. Gosh, there are people who still are devoted to it. I had a client who had a collection of them. Anyway, yeah. Erno Rubik.
And it's actually evolved because in addition to the cubes, they have created other Rubik's shapes. I saw one that was in the shape of a pyramid. And I thought, wow, I mean, and it was very interesting how they moved that one around. It's just fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. 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 It originally designed, I can just see it, classed in 1975 when the professor says, okay, I've got these little toys to play with. Let's see how you do. Yeah. Mm. This is another sad story about the way that art and beautiful things of ancient provenance, how fast they can be taken away from us. Out of a collection of 4,000 paintings, only 200 paintings were saved from a fire at a museum in Russian-controlled Georgia. And this particular museum was known for its work of Georgian painters, you know, Georgian, not Georgia like American state, but the Georgia in Russia.
Yeah.
And apparently in the middle of the night, some of the devoted workers from the museum were on alert and showed up and were physically fighting the fires to take canvases out by hand, you know, taking them off the walls and running with them out the museum. And they managed to save 200. Very sad. A new museum for culture and identity of Lithuanian Jews has opened with an exhibit. This is in Lithuania. It's opened with an exhibit on a very famous Lithuanian Jew by the name of Leonard Cohen, the poet and songwriter.
Oh, really?
Who lived from 1934. Yeah, 1934 to 2016. It's amazing. And then, you know, this is part of the thing that a lot of these smaller museums are devoted to certain things. Now we hear the Georgia Museum and the Lithuanian Museum, etc. A looted Roman breastplate. Okay, so this was an area right here underneath the clavicle that was very exposed. Usually it was between, you know, your armor and your headpiece. Right here where, you know, there's this, right here, Richard, where your throat is.
Yeah.
That was an area where it was easily attacked. And so they made very beautiful breastplates over the many years. A breastplate was part of going to battle. And as late as the Civil War, people still used breastplates. This is a looted Roman breastplate from 300 BCE. We think it's looted, we're not sure, but it was withdrawn from Christie's sale of arms and armor, and the whole entire museum in Mogens, which is in France, Museum of Classical Art is being auctioned at Christie's, mostly arms and armor. The looting was discovered by another, we talked a little bit about the FBI Art Crimes Division. Well, UNESCO has an Art Crimes Division as well. It's called the Illicit Antiquities Trafficking Agency. And so UNESCO heard about this breastplate and was researching the provenance, where it came from. And there's a hiccup in the provenance. Usually with the work of art, there's this person owned it, this museum showed it, this museum showed it, this person owned it, da-da-da-da-da. And it chronologically works. And there's a dealer who was known to be a grave robber in the history of this breastplate. And we don't know if it's looted, but UNESCO is saying, no, it probably was. So anyway, I'd like to go to a quick break. And then I want to talk to you about a little Brooklyn gallery that's called B Dry Goods. And it's a recent discovery. And if anybody's going to New York City in the near future, I want to hear from you. And I want to hear if you can check out this little gallery for me. It's pretty important, and it's a really interesting take on a collection of curiosities. Not necessarily art, not necessarily any collectibles, but curiosities. It's a really cool idea. We'll talk about this. The little Brooklyn gallery called D, as in the letter D, Dry Goods. They've got all kinds of cool stuff. We'll talk about that when we get back from the break. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Richard, when I do these state of the art and collectible and material culture, I guess you'd call it. When I do these state of the art world, I tend to say that art encompasses a lot of different objects. And here's a good example. This is a little Brooklyn gallery called B Dry Goods in Brooklyn, New York, and they have such things as Andy Warhol's Keith Haring shirt, Josephine Baker's banana belt that she wore when she was shimmying in the 20s, David Hockney's red bow tie. They have these sorts of things, highly collectible things, and they are for sale, and they are displayed beautifully. I mean, so Andy Warhol did a sketch of Keith Haring on a t-shirt, and somehow it ended up screen printed as is circa 1986, and there weren't many copies made, but they are available. If you want a t-shirt, it's going to be $2,000.
Oh, man.
But yeah, I always watch the runway shows. I love fashion. And I watch the runway shows. They just ended in Paris. And then, of course, they have the women's and they have the men's collections. And boy, I really enjoy the fashion week in Paris. And then New York Fashion Week is in a couple of weeks. It starts in a couple of weeks. But the show that's at this little gallery is called Fashion Forward, and the theme is wearable things that are highly collectible. And this is a gallery show where things are for sale, and it's open now through March 30th. And like I said, if you're going to New York City, I want you to take a look at this and report back to me. It's tucked away on a side street in Crown Heights. It's like a high-end curiosity shop. The objects are hung densely, stacked high. They're handpicked by the gallerist, Gabe Boyers, who is curating the 170 items on display. What's on display, most of it is for sale. It ranges from vintage mementos to contemporary finds, and it's anything that this gentleman, Gabe, thinks is going to be fun to look at. For example, a telephone-shaped, do you remember telephone dials? You remember the round telephone?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So there's a round telephone dial And it's got the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 little slots for your fingers to turn.
Yeah, yeah.
And a little kind of catch that, you know, stops your finger from turning. Anyway, those were those dials. Usually in the middle of those dials, they had your phone number.
Right. On a little I remember.
Remember those? Okay. So in the 1950s, Elsa Schiaparelli came up with a compact, a powder compact, where the top of it was a phone dial in the 1930s. And it's based on a design by Salvador Dali. And, you know, Salvador Dali and Elsa Schiaparelli were friends. And by the way, Richard, I have an amazing hat. Can you see my can you see my hands, Richard? Look at my hands.
Here's my hands.
I'm putting them on top of my head.
Right.
And rising up straight, vertically.
Right.
Is a felt shoe. and that was a design by Dali and Schiaparelli. And the other famous hat that they designed, both of them together, was a lobster claw. So you know, these are works of art, I guess.
Wow.
Andy Warhol designed a dress called the Super Dress. Can you guess how super is spelled? Remember his Campbell Soups? This is S-O-U-P-E-R, Super Dress, 1965. It's an A-line dress made of screen-printed tissue. You could order, actually, you didn't order them. He sent these to his friends in the mail, and they arrived in an envelope all folded up. And it's a little dress for a woman, and it sells for $4,500 these days. And it is the screen print of his famous soup cans all the way down the dress. And it's made of tissue paper.
Wow.
And then, let's see, other paper dresses that various artists and various companies made that were kind of knockoffs of Warhol. Outside face of Bob Dylan repeated down the dress, made of paper. That was made by Campbell's Soup. That was capitalizing on the Warhol craze. You know, they called it the Warhol Super Dress. And there were a number of them made. You could find them folded inside a magazine in the 60s.
You know, it's one of the reasons why I don't own expensive clothing. Because I wouldn't want to wear it out of the house, let alone in the house. Because it's like, are you kidding? I mean, I'm not the kind of guy that has that kind of disposable income anyway, but I really do think that even if I did, I mean, the most expensive shoes I have ever bought were $150 shoes, and they actually lasted 13 years, and I wore them every day. Seriously, they were my work shoes for, you know, going to and from the radio station.
Wow. So. In this gallery, we're talking about this little gallery in Brooklyn. And they also have a group of items that belong to the famous singer Josephine Baker.
Oh, wow.
They've got a feathery pink hat, similar to the one she wore to the Battle of Versailles. And it was a dance number. And her famous or infamous banana belt from the 1930s, where she wore that around her waist and not much else in Paris. And and she danced with that. And this particular gallery owns this belt, and they acquired them from a Paris sale of items deaccessioned by France's National Public Radio. How the public radio had this banana belt, I do not know, but they did. It's a stunning find, and that's available for sale for $25,000.
And I'm only guessing, was it made from the elements from the tree? And the fruit?
Not really. It's a fabric that was made from the bark of the tree.
Oh, okay. All right.
But yeah, let's see. Vogue editor did a portfolio of original fashions by the French poster artist Paul Collin, and some of these were kind of purloined by the famous designer Karl Lagerfeld. Mm. And these particular prints were used Baker, Josephine Baker, as a model. Mm-hmm. And they were published unbound in 1930. And they depict Josephine Baker as very young, fresh-faced. She's her journey from a small Missouri town to the center of the Paris Beau Monde was amazing. And, you know, the sketches and the photos where the sketches were produced from, they're actually, they had been owned by Karl Lagerfeld, and they are available at this tiny little gallery as well. Also, the centerpiece of the particular show at the at this little gallery in Brooklyn is, believe it or not, a large trunk formerly owned by the Queen Marie Antoinette.
Wow.
And okay. This trunk was, it's battered, it's beat up, it has her name on it, has this royal sign on it, etc. It was battered by many journeys in horse-drawn carriages on unpaved roads, used to transport Marie Antoinette's famous gowns and finery from palace to palace. So, you know, the trunk maker at Versailles made this specially for her. She had hundreds of trunks, and basically there's only three of them left in the world that they were used and packed in many, many carriages because she always traveled with all of her finery. Just amazing because it was found in a tiny little shop, and somebody figured out what it was because on the top it says Garde-robe de la Reine, in other words, wardrobe of the queen.
Mm. Wow.
He's asking $200,000, and that is not unreasonable when you consider that Louis Vuitton trunks, Richard, are highly collectible, and they go for $280,000 somewhere in that range. Yeah.
Just give
the
me
highest
some,
price.
Yeah, just give me ahead. Some Samsonite luggage, and I'll put the $200,000
yeah,
in cash
right.
in that.
Right. So that's kind of the stuff that, you know, and basically get back from the break, I'd like to tell you a few more things that have been collected that are very unique. And it's just a cool idea.
Yeah.
I want to collect anything that I think is unique, and I'm going to call it art. And matter of fact, it works.
Yeah.
Okay, don't turn that down. Back in a minute. So also in this little gallery, we've got things like a collection of drawings by Givenchy for costume designs for the Bolshoi Ballet's production of Giselle in 1997. The archive is selling for $250,000. A necktie. So David Hockney, the artist, is famous for wearing bow ties. And there's a necktie that's going to be sold for $8,500 at this Dry Goods gallery. And a fabric mold designed by Sonia Delaunay. And then famous footwear designed by Converse, celebrating the Air Force One shoe. A metal couture belt attributed to Paco Rabanne, 1970. An Oleg Cassini outfit with a handwritten message from Jacqueline Kennedy ordering one from the designer. I want one, she says. A great wool dress. I would love this. And a bronze Roman belt buckle dating back to 100 BCE.
Mm, wow.
And that's all in one collection. How cool is that? A bralette made out of thousands of metal screws.
What?
So metal screws, the screw heads are against the skin.
Oh, okay.
And the screw, it's facing outward. This is designed by New York artist Patrice Jordan, who is a living artist in New York. And that would make quite a startling message on a first date.
That sounds an awful lot like a Madonna-esque.
Yeah, I think so. And then we talked about paper dresses. They're difficult if it's raining outside, as you mentioned, et cetera. And then there's also a lot of interesting paintings that the curator picked up, just as I picked paintings up that were orphans, that he just thought, God, this is cool. How interesting is that? Yeah. Thanks, Richard. I appreciate
it. Oh, you're very welcome. This is fascinating. And, of course, all of this can be found in your storage locker, right?
Yeah, right. Which I pay $300 a month. I have two storage lockers.
There you go. All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you next week.
Okay. Bye, Richard.